You have to be able to invest in a controlled fashion in areas that you think or believe, or in some cases know, are a tremendous opportunity that may be way too early for anyone to have to also recognize that.
Welcome to The Ultimate Guide to Partnering. In this podcast, Vince Menzione, a proven industry sales and partner executive, brings together technology leaders in this forum to discuss transformational trends and to deconstruct successful strategies to thrive and survive in the rapid age of cloud transformation. And now your host, Vince Menzione.
Welcome to the 37th and a very special encore episode recorded live at the Channel Company's Next Gen Conference in Los Angeles, California. My encore guest, Tony Savoyan, is the CEO of SADA Systems, a family-owned company that has grown from a small IT shop to $100 million in annual revenue and premier partner status with Facebook, Google, and Microsoft. Tony was an early guest, episode 3 of the podcast, and Tony and I met here for an update on the transformation going on in technology, why he's investing millions in the cloud, how he's recruiting and hiring top talent, and where he sees the future growth in 2018. As with each of my episodes, I appreciate your support. Please subscribe to the podcast and tell your friends about it. And I'd love your feedback. Please provide a review or drop me a line at vincem@cloudwaypartners.net. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed this episode.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Vince Menzione. I'm the founder of CloudWave Partners and also the host of a podcast called The Ultimate Guide to Partnering. We started the podcast earlier this year, and it's focused on helping technology partners to connect and thrive in this age of transformation. Focused in quite a bit on the Microsoft ecosystem. I have guests from both Microsoft and partners that have gotten it right. And a very early episode of the podcast, episode 3, was Tony Savoyan, CEO of SADA Systems. Tony has agreed to join me for this live interview today with all of you. We are recording this and hope to use the content from today's session. Tony's episode was our most downloaded podcast. And so, Tony, welcome to the Next Gen Conference.
Thanks for having me back, Vince.
It's great to have you. You're the CEO of SADA Systems, a born-in-the-cloud partner that has done quite a bit of work in the nexus of this transformation, and happy to have you here with our listeners talking about what's happening in the cloud, what's happening in terms of the transformation today. I thought maybe for our audience here today, you could tell a little bit about your story, about the company, what your role is, and the mission of the organization.
Sure. So I'm the CEO and president of SADA Systems. We're called a born in the cloud partner. What's ironic about that is we've been doing this for 17 and a half years, so way before the cloud was a thing. And I like that the sort of orientation around Next Gen Conference is really around MSPs, because that was really our first business in 2002 or thereabouts that we launched, that we started to fall in love with the concept of consumption economics, recurring revenue, incentive alignment with our customers. Before that, I think the world of IT and the value that we added was so much more reactive and sort of break-fix oriented. So having that in mind, being Los Angeles based, and it's great to be here in our home city as well doing this, is that was the first business that scaled quickly for us, recurring revenue oriented in nature, but also incentive aligned with our customers and preventative, proactive, sort of forward-looking approach into IT management and strategy. Was a novel concept, so it took off quickly. And that made us fall in love with the model, and we scaled quickly. Customers wanted a lot of it, and we soon realized how there was a natural sort of barrier to scale in that model that was very on-premise oriented at the time. So quickly after that, a year or two of doing that, we started to explore ways to scale that out. And we took two of our managed customers, put them on Terminal Server and Citrix, and hosted their mail and sort of office experience through a terminal environment out of a data center. And we thought that was really novel. That was great. Like, that way we can sell anywhere, we could deliver services to any customer, and we wouldn't have to sort of do the rotation of visiting each one of their sites on the regular basis like we did, and that way we could grow the business. We soon realized how a little ahead of its time, but certainly how expensive and difficult that was to do. That was an ambition and endeavor that ultimately failed, so we scaled back those customers. Thankfully, we kept them. We moved them back on-premise in the traditional model. But we had that sort of inkling that there was something beyond what we were doing with regards to managed services. And incidentally, around 2005 or 6, I saw an ad somewhere around what Google was doing in the enterprise. Around then, it was just enterprise search, sort of behind the firewall enterprise search. And that wasn't directly in our wheelhouse, but we knew that we could take some of our custom development capabilities and our Microsoft knowledge and try to tackle that. And so we started a partnership with Google then and didn't sell any search appliances. But what happened was the 50-person Google Enterprise team back then became aware of our Microsoft expertise and our sort of forward-looking views on technology and market value. And they tapped us on the shoulder to become a launch partner when Google Apps came out as a product in February of 2007. And that was truly the thing that a decade ago or so, almost 11 years now, catapulted us into a national player in the world of IT services. Our first customer was Northwestern University. So I think it was only the second ever customer to go Google at the time. And all of a sudden, you know, this SoCal-based IT shop was doing work remotely, you know, in Illinois, and it was fantastic. And that was sort of the epitome of what we were trying to do on our own, that we realized we could do now with a partner in an area where we didn't have to develop and invest our own data center technology and our own just sort of hardware and services capabilities. Somebody else was going to do that, and we just had to find the right value proposition to come in between. Now, fast forward, 2008 or 9, Microsoft is now also looking at the cloud as a serious opportunity and, frankly, a threat at the time. And we were always a Microsoft partner, and they tapped us on the shoulder to help them drive what was then BPOS and then became Office 365. And so we really focused on those two partnerships for many years until last year we signed up. We had, you know, smaller partnerships and still do. And that's growing a little bit for us, but our first big third partner became Facebook with their workplace product that they launched last year.
And I met you when I was running Microsoft's public sector partner strategy. You were education partner of the year not long after starting up and with Microsoft. Yeah. Again, going after that education vertical is important.
Los Angeles Unified School District, I think, was that's the project that put us on the map there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Still the biggest school district to ever go Office 365.
Yeah. And fast forward from there, premier partnership with Microsoft, part of the NSP program at the time, their most coveted partners, premier status with both Facebook and with Google now. So a lot of the people in the room, our audience, a lot of the partners I work with are trying, they aspire to get to that level. Like, how do I become a premier partner? How do I get to that level of sophistication and integration with that tech giant? How do you do it today, first of all? And then also, how do you keep the lines clear between the field organizations working across those three technology giants?
So I think part of becoming premier with any partner is just a sort of a decision you make around being focused in your investments. We were just very narrow and deep with both Google and Microsoft. And when we choose to do something at scale, and we may be incubating for many years before we make that decision, but when we decided to do it, we really kind of go all in and put in the structure and the incentive orientation within the company to make sure that that is an area of focus for us. The way that I think you become valuable to your partners is sort of you reverse the way you normally think in running a business. And most businesses think about maximizing revenue to themselves and profits to themselves, which is important. Without that, we can't sustain and grow our businesses and continue to reinvest. But I think we figured out early on that if we kind of align our incentives with what our partners are trying to achieve, both the individuals within the ecosystem we work with, like our channel manager or the field sellers we work with at Google and Microsoft, if we make them successful, we drive revenue to them. I think it creates immediate sort of elevation of your status to the degree that they can measure it, and they can measure it in various ways, of course, but more importantly, you create a relationship in which you help retire quota for these reps and these other business units, and all of a sudden there's a natural reciprocity that occurs where they're thinking of you first, they're recommending you first. Of course, you have to show you the ability to deliver on those promises and the sales that you close, you have to make those successful. So you have to have excellent engineering and delivery capability to cover that. But the other challenge soon became, to your point, Vince, is how do you balance two big giants who, frankly, especially at the time, were absolute direct competitors?
Yeah.
And that's when we got the idea of actually segmenting the business. So we built siloed sales and delivery organizations, and that accomplished a couple of things. First and foremost, it's, again, that mantra of hyper-specialization. We just chose to become very deep in our expertise and knowledge and groups that were focused just on G Suite and then just on Maps and just on Search on the Google side, just on sort of Office 365 and just on, you know, infrastructure, just on Dynamics, so on and so forth. But you also create the firewalls and the dedicated teams such that when you're selling with your partner in the co-selling motion, they realize that they are with you, win, lose, or draw, in the opportunities that they're pursuing, and that you're not just a hyper-agnostic cloud broker who will just sell anything the customer wants. If they realize you're in it with them to the end, regardless of outcome, that builds trust.
Yeah. So I talk to my listeners about what makes great partnerships and the transformation that's happening so fast. What do you think separates SADA Systems, both in the market and from an industry perspective? What makes you a great partner?
I think at the sort of root level is our ability to recognize trends. We've had some natural ability over time, but I think now, and that's the case for all of you guys who've been doing something for a long time, you start to develop somewhat of an instinct, but beyond the instincts is you start to have a critical mass of customers, deep relationship with your vendors, you have your pulse on the market, such that, you know, if you're listening, they'll tell you where they're going, customers will tell you what they want, market research will tell you what customers broadly want, that are not even your customers, but what the market wants, and really what the strategic initiatives around your partners are. You get sort of inside information around that, and you drive your strategy around that. And you continue to double down on the things that they work, that are working, and again, hyper-focus. The ability to evolve, though, is sort of the Darwinian concept of it's not the strongest or the biggest that survive over time, it's the ones who are the most adaptable. And that requires a certain culture oriented towards speed, humility. We don't have sacred cows, you know, certain things don't pan out, you know, we have to have the wherewithal to pivot and change. And another thing is it's expensive to invest in new capabilities and new technologies. It's something we continue to chase, and it's only getting more rapid in evolution. What we've done is created a culture of people who want to create great transformational opportunities for us and for our customers and for the market. But also, you have to have a model for what I call sort of incubation micro-investing. You know, you have to be able to invest in a controlled fashion in areas that you think or believe or in some cases know are a tremendous opportunity that may be way too early for anyone to have to also recognize that. Google Cloud, for instance, we invested in years, 5 or 6 years before it became a thing we could resell or a thing that was even, you know, had a clear path and guidance from Google. But we knew it was a thing, and we knew it was going to become a relevant infrastructure and platform option in the market. But you have to do it, especially for a lot of us who are self-funded and have sort of operational cash flow as the limiter to our investment capability. You have to be able to invest in that in a micro fashion as to not overextend, but also not give up. You know, if you're certain about certain, you know, investments and strategies, you may be the only one doing it. It may be so early that there's no revenues, but it's almost like having a startup engine within your own organization that you can manage.
So what informs those decisions? Is it customer-driven? Is it technology giant-driven? What informs those micro-investments that you make?
I think developing close relationship with your partners has that added advantage of giving you sometimes direct information around where they're going and where their big bets are, but sometimes it's sort of heuristical information you pick up from many sources and synthesize together. Like, what are the different sales groups saying in the products and leadership? What's coming out of their mouths? What are they giving up sometimes unwittingly about what their strategy might be? But having a sizable and sort of a critical mass, size of customers, if you can really, you know, you listen to your customers, they'll tell you where what their needs are going to be, and what they are, and what they're struggling with. I just think that's really important.
So are you willing to share with our audience where you're investing today for the future?
Sure. That's why I'm here, right?
Absolutely.
So it continues to be multifaceted. Sometimes we get criticized for trying to do too many things, but certainly we believe that there's plenty of work left to do in a very sort of brass tacks, blocking and tackling of migration to the cloud, of basic workloads, email, storage, collaboration, and the managed services around those. I think only 20% of the world's email, just email, is in the cloud today. 5 or 6 or 7% of the data center footprint. So just lots of migration work left to do, and still sort of anybody's game. And it's usually also a pretty good entry point to most customers, especially if you have tight relationships with them and the vendors. Those are a good entry point. That's the first signal that a customer is ready to do cloud at all, is when they talk about basic workloads, usually, you know, starting with email, etc. Beyond that, though, what our customers are starting to realize and expect and say is that the destination to cloud is not the end. It's sort of a starting point for them. Once they get there, they really are interested in having us help them transform certain parts of their business in terms of what they do, how they manage information, the tools and services they build for themselves to be more competitive than their peers. And so through those conversations, and usually those conversations don't happen just in IT, which is often the entry point for most of us. It's really line of business that ends up having those needs, or maybe it's things that they've been talking about for months or years with their CIO peers, but haven't gotten a lot of traction around. Is if we can play a role in brokering those conversations within our customers between IT and line of business, that's where the needs will be surfaced. So we're doing all sorts of interesting things, like for a major transportation group, sort of a bus transit company, you know, rebuilding their entire ticketing platform around how their customers buy and utilize just tickets to ride around. Or for departments of transportation in cities, we're building new ways for them to manage their construction projects within the cities that cause road closures, and coordination between the cable company and the gas company in terms of when and how they dig up streets and things like that. We're having customers continue to harp on how the management of data and information is extremely paramount to them, and it will continue to be. They're all being able to collect data now in ways that it couldn't before, but the sort of the art and science of surfacing that information to help them make the best decisions, better decisions than their competitors. Things like Power BI and some other tools are being, you know, very sort of relevant to that as well. And again, it's these are digital transformation type projects that happen in conversations, often outside of the CIO's office.
So we met about 7 months ago, and I've been hearing since our interview and all the interviews I've done, sort of the theme has been that the transformation is happening faster than most organizations expected it to happen. What are you seeing that you didn't expect to happen this soon?
I think what I didn't expect to happen was the real need and evidence that supports that in practice now, that the future is a multi-cloud world. I think every customer that we talk to that's running some things on-premise, some things in a colo, some things with Amazon, etc., they all want to create experiences and platforms and tools and strategies that drive best of breed from the different cloud vendors. And the world of sort of a homogeneous IT environment is, I think, going away faster than what we thought. Anybody who's running everything on Amazon wants to diversify and run some stuff on, you know, on GCP or Azure, vice versa, right? So it's causing us to kind of, you know, we talked about new partnerships and new technologies and things to address the Amazon market in a way that we haven't before. And because our customers are asking us, not because we have this ambition to build a fourth standalone practice. I think the practices are converging. There's customers who want to, you know, build something on Azure but use Google Maps, you know, these sort of heterogeneous ambitions. And that makes sense. And it's another thing that's really true to form in terms of cloud migration. The reason I think the cloud workload migration to cloud isn't happening much faster is because initially I think there was some evidence to support that all customers wanted to do was move the data center to the cloud, and that was the end game. It actually turns out that there's very little appetite to do just that alone. What customers expect us to do is show the benefits of doing that above and beyond, oh, I don't have to manage the servers anymore, because you still do in reality. It's really about how we can re-architect their environments using microservices and containerization and those technologies to give them better performance in this new world, much lower cost profile. And also in the context of multi-cloud, once you do that, it gives their applications sort of ultimate portability. They can move stuff from one cloud to another seamlessly in that world. So multi-cloud is big. Ambitions to really transform the way IT is operationalized is big. It's not just moving to the cloud. And another thing that's becoming apparent to us and our partners, and we first saw this in our partners, it's another great way to get signals, right, is that the sales process now is becoming influenced by two things in a significant way. One is the sale of a collaboration platform is somewhat technical, but it's really more about organizational change and adoption and training and those kind of things. But the sale of a big digital transformation project or data center move or any of those kind of things, they're very much more so technical in nature. Less political, less cultural. There's some culture, of course, but it's really about they're very deeply technical in nature, such to a degree that before you used to have like maybe one sales engineer supporting three sellers or something like that. And now you need like the reverse. You need like three sales engineers supporting one seller, because it takes earning the credibility and the confidence of the application teams and the data center teams and those owners who are extremely powerful within our clients to make the decision of which platform to use. So it's a deep, long sales cycle that's one on the merits of the technical capabilities, sometimes more than price or anything else. So that's been a wake-up call for us, certainly.
Yeah. So I'm going to shift gears here and talk a little bit about culture. One of the key ingredients I've seen in organizations that have made the transformation is this grit and determination. And that's true of any bootstrapping of any organization. Your organization has grown from a small IT shop to this premier status and has grown significantly over the years. I know that your parents and your family emigrated from Soviet Armenia in the 80s. Yeah. And how is that, I think about the grit and determination coming from that environment to the United States, how has that influenced your business, your business philosophy, and how you view the business and the growth of the organization?
So you can try to make me cry on stage.
No.
So I think we're all immigrants to some degree, and we have a history of that in all of our roots. I think what I love about SADA and our story is it's a great American immigration story of a family coming and doing something that they couldn't do anywhere else in the world. I'm also biased to the West Coast, so I say it's sort of a West Coast immigrant story. It's the Wild West out here still in some ways, where everybody will give you a shot. I think it's multiple things. I think you come from an environment where you have nothing to lose, so it's not very risky to bet at all on a great idea. But I think it comes down to a deep appreciation of how we all got here, all of us. It's not just about first generation. All of our ancestors must have done a lot of things right and been pretty smart for us to just be born and be able to be here in this country to do these kind of things that we're doing. So it's deep appreciation for that. And also kind of a sense of obligation and gratitude. Like, I think we're obligated to do something big or try because of the opportunity we've been given. I think it has a lot to do with that.
So talk a little bit more about culture and attracting and retaining talent, because it's so difficult today, right, in high tech to find the right people, especially with the new technologies that are emerging and the need to be deep in things like AI and data. So how do you do that? How do you get the right people?
So types of people that we have to bring on today are the exact types that could go work at Google, Amazon, or Facebook, Cisco, anywhere else, right? It's, you know, we have a culture of the type of people we attract, I think, are that have that level of talent, but also want to make a bigger impact, a disproportional impact to the market and to our customers relative to being a cog in a bigger machine. And so that is challenging to find, especially as we create these new sets of offerings and capabilities. You're totally right. I mean, we didn't have UX, UI experts before. We didn't have data scientists before. We didn't have cloud architects before. So we've literally had to create a culture that enables these people to thrive in a way they can't in a larger company. I think a lot of it has to do with autonomy and trust and betting big on their ideas and giving them a lot of space to do well. But it also has to do with creating a real recruitment engine. You know, we've had a new hire, and one of the key new hires we made last couple of years was literally head of talent acquisition. You know, it's a full-time role. It's not the generalist HR function anymore to be able to recruit and retain talent. I think talent acquisition is a key differentiator and actually a necessary catalyst to our growth. Maybe the only barrier to our growth long-term is our ability to recruit and retain the best talent. So we made it a dedicated function. Now we have 3 full-time recruiters in-house, and we also use every other agency. Shameless plug, we're hiring a lot right now. So we have 180 people. I think we have 35 open requisitions. Wow. So part of it is the ability to grow internally, grow people into roles. And I'm very proud to look across our organization and see the person running our sort of Microsoft practice, a person, someone who started at the help desk 7 years ago or something like that. We have many examples of that. But right now we're also having to hire more senior VP, C-level industry experts as well to kind of round out not the technical skill gap itself, but really the experience gap. You know, we're crossing this $100 million mark and things are becoming more serious. Our customers are expecting more. So we like to use a dual prong strategy of growing from within and then also hiring from the outside. And it is absolutely, to your point, a competitive landscape where great technical talent and sales talent can go pretty much anywhere these days.
So you and I have talked about the gap of women in technology, right? So how do you think about that, and how do you recruit great women into the organization as well?
Timely question. Hi, Mom. She's right there. That's Annie Safoyan right there. She's one of the founders of SADA. It's definitely one of the reasons. Growing up, I've always been surrounded by just super independent, powerful women, from my mom to my aunts and my grandma, etc. And when we started this thing, I think back in 2005, I think Annie remembers, my mom remembers, I think there was 20 people and, 1.5 women. So we had my mom and an intern, the rest were men. And I really like how the markets evolved. And as we recruit from schools, we see, more and more women pursuing technical degrees and engineering degrees. I think some of the big schools have more women than men. A lot of the computer science programs are just fantastic to see. But not just women, but I think diversity at SADA has been a huge player. It's had a huge role in our success. Just, whether or not we don't sell that much outside of North America, but the reality is most of our customers themselves are heterogeneous in nature, from decision makers to stakeholders, and just having that view and diversity. Or when you send a team that looks like the United Nations, and as a cross-functional team, I think that's that gains a lot of credibility. I think it's also what makes SADA unique in perspective.
So 2018 is just around the corner. What are you seeing in terms of the big bets and initiatives moving into 18 and maybe even over the next 18 months? Where do you see the future taking us, Tony?
I'm glad you didn't ask the 5-year question, because
no.
When people ask the 5, I'm like, that's crazy. It's impossible to predict that far along. But so again, I think we're at still the very beginning. It's sort of like the second inning of this big cloud transformation journey for all of us. I think lots of basic blocking and tackling left to do. We think our core email collaboration migration business will grow 50% next year, you know, something like that. But again, the bigger opportunity, when Satya Nadella talks about the $4.5 trillion of opportunity now that he sees from Microsoft's standpoint, which is what he said in Inspire in July.
Yeah.
It was like $2.5 trillion a couple of years ago. What we're seeing driving that is around new capabilities that are above and beyond cost shifting. So a lot of the work we've done in the past has been cost shifting. You know, stuff used to be hosted here, now it's hosted there, and you don't, you know, use a data center anymore, you use Azure or something else. But our customers, and one comes to mind as a great example. So, you know, they'll never spend more than $200,000 a year on email collaboration. That's just their subscription. They'll never have more than 5,000 employees or whatever it is. It's a nonprofit. But they're already spending, you know, $1 million a month on cloud platform trying to build the world's preeminent open source genomics research, you know, organization. So that $4.5 trillion or $2.5 trillion additional, it's not the existing stuff that companies used to do. It's the new ambitions that they're undertaking because now it's possible. It's not like, oh, we used to cure cancer in Oracle and now we're going to do it in the cloud. They just couldn't do it before. And that's an extreme example, but I think that's indicative of the types of opportunities that are now, you know, we're being challenged by and have to adapt to continue to be relevant.
It's a brave new world.
Serious.
If we have a couple minutes, I'd like to open up the floor to any questions. We do have a mic up here, and I've asked you several questions, but I don't know if there's any from our guests here.
Can you go on the mic so we can record it?
Yeah, we have a mic right here so we can record it. Thank you.
New Facebook partnership, what's going on? What do you see over there?
Great question. So Facebook, I think, is indicative of couple things. One is it's the way we got into the program was because of someone at Google who we work with for many years went there and kind of tapped us on the shoulder to help them launch the sort of the channel strategy, etc. And there's multiple layers to this, but we believe that to date, both Google and Microsoft have kind of missed the social enterprise strategy. Certainly, Google tried with Google Plus, and Microsoft did with Yammer. They're both sort of pivoting, right? I think they're launching certain other things that kind of look like Slack and things like that because they understand the communication paradigm is changing. We felt that there was a gap in truly connecting the fabric of our customers' employees in an intuitive and native fashion. So when we saw the vision that Facebook was truly trying to bring to market, which is not a departmental use case like Slack and others to just have a different communication paradigm than email, this was a top-down cultural shift around people being connected no matter where they were on whatever device in an intuitive platform. We really thought there was a place in the marketplace for that. There's also sort of a bigger market signal, and it's kind of what we saw with Google a decade ago. These consumer-driven companies that have made all their money on ads and advertising, that's not over, but it will plateau. There's simply, I think, a limit of, you know, when you get to a certain size, there's only so much more ad revenue growth that's possible. But then Google looked at enterprise 10 years ago and said, oh my God, it's untapped. And that's a much bigger market than advertising. So they started to pivot. And I think Facebook is kind of right there in this point in time. And I think they'll add additional capabilities on the platform. Mm-hmm. But we've seen a big culture shift at SADA by using the platform. First of all, it's cross-platform. So whether you're on the Google platform or Microsoft platform, everybody can use it sort of as a first-class citizen. But also, we used to use other tools or tried other tools, whether it was kind of, you know, Yammer or Podio or some of these other platforms. The Facebook set of applications is just, to me, as far, especially in the mobile approach, is so intuitive that the adoption is much easier. And we're not that big, 180 employees relative to some of the huge companies that are deploying it now. But I immediately feel more connected to all the people we have now spread around the country and the new hires we make. We know about them before they come on. So it's created a much closer connection culturally for our employees.
I think we have one more.
One of the themes that keeps running throughout this conference is the multi-cloud. In addition to Amazon and Microsoft Azure, is Google and VMware, among others, forces to be reckoned with as well?
Google, certainly. And that's one that we're very close to. And we think, of course, Amazon is the 800-pound gorilla in the space. They started much earlier than anyone else, and they focused on what people were ready to do then, which is just infrastructure. And that was their roots. Both Microsoft and Google start on the platform side. They want to create really interesting platform services. Too early for the market back then. But both Microsoft and Google certainly have invested much more in their infrastructure capabilities. Google swears up and down that they will be the low-cost, high-performance provider in infrastructure as a service. And they think they have superior technology and better data center strategy and lower costs than anyone else. And we're seeing a significant amount of demand for that. And we're amongst the top resellers for Google Cloud in a very early nascent market for partners in North America. So we're seeing a lot of that activity. So Google certainly, VMware, I think, they no longer have a cloud strategy. I think they're partnering to achieve that.
So they're partnering across the three, actually.
They are. Yeah. So I would watch Google very closely.
Yeah. One more question.
Thanks, Walter.
When I think about your company, when we used to work together, kind of a mid-sized MSP, and now you've made this transitive change to an enterprise company partnering with Google and Facebook. When I look at the landscape, a lot of MSPs out there, they stay small. What do you think one of the main principles that you have helped you make that transformation from a small MSP or midsize to this enterprise company?
Good question.
I think it's a decision you have to make. There's a lot of players, and we were one that was a regional, what we could be classified, maybe incorrectly, but sort of a lifestyle business, right? And I think there's merits to that. there's a lot of wonderful lifestyle businesses in the IT space that purposefully, that's the strategy that they're running. And I think that's fantastic. It's a costly proposition on a sort of personal level to decide to break beyond that, because it requires stretching beyond your comfort zones, both your own knowledge gaps and experience gaps, but also economically you have to take some big bets. And you have to sacrifice a lot, personally. Time and away from the family and financial risk and hiring and up-leveling your systems to be more enterprise. It's not for everyone. And I think it's sort of a cost-benefit analysis that I think business owners first and foremost have to do to see if they're willing to go down that journey. If you do want to go down that journey, again, I think it just requires hyper focus around doing some things, only a few things, definitively better than the rest. And you have to choose what those things are. Hopefully the things that the market wants and your partners are going to be supportive of you doing. And then it's mutual investment. Our partners invest in us. We invest in them. We go to market, very committed fashion, but it's a,
from the other side watching, I would say it was a willingness to be all in with Microsoft, to take on the workloads and the things, all the asks that come out from the field, right?
There's a lot of
requests to do that. And then there was a commitment, and I see this in organizations that are successful, is that CEO, from the CEO level down throughout the organization, that commitment to the success of the partnership. And everyone in the organization is just forward thinking into that commitment. And I saw that with Sada as well.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about the business operating system framework. I think that's a good guidance. There's a couple of books on that.
Yeah.
You have to systematize a lot of things. You have to take yourself out of the loop as a owner, as a CEO, of a lot of processes to be able to do things like this and work to scale the business. So there's a lot to it, but it's first and foremost, it's a decision you have to make. Red pill, blue pill.
Blue pill, yeah. Well, I think we're coming up on time, Tony. I want to thank you for taking time from your compressed schedule. I know this is year end and the holidays and a lot of things going on right now. Really appreciate you coming here today to be with our audience and to share your experiences.
It's always a pleasure, Vince. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you,
buddy.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of The Ultimate Guide to Partnering with your host, Vince Menzione. Online at ultimateguidetopartnering.com and facebook.com/ultimateguidetopartnering. We'll catch you next time on The Ultimate Guide to Partnering.